Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. It is episode number 248, only two away from our extra special 250th episode. That's coming at you in just 2 weeks. So exciting. In the meantime, hey, get in touch with us. Drop us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. If you have any guest suggestions, if there are folks you want to see on this show, just send us an email. And hey, we'll try to get them. Follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. We've been tweeting more and more. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to follow all the fun things happening on our little gay radio show that could. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. An incredible show for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Katie Glover is the editor of Frock Magazine, an award-winning, glossy, bi-monthly magazine that's aimed squarely at the transgender community. This free, it is free, and truly stunning publication is full of trans-related articles, features, and stories that will be of interest to just any of you who pick it up. Frock was the recipient of the 2013 Magazine Publishers Award for Best Niche Magazine. Katie is also the creator of the Gender Society, a virtual meeting place that we're going to talk all about. Coming to us from all the way across the pond in merry old England, Katie Glover, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, hi.
How are things in England?
Oh, miserable. Not so bad, really, but the weather's a bit depressing.
What is stunning weather in England? Because we always hear that it's a little bit rainy and depressing.
Oh, well, it is midwinter.
Yeah.
So, but the trouble is our winter goes on so long, you know, and it rains all the time. It's like living in Seattle.
Nice.
It gets dark early and it's cloudy and just a bit depressing, really. You know?
All right, well, let's liven things up, Katie, because we have a lot of exciting things to talk about. Are you ready?
Yay!
All right. Well, take us back, Katie. The year is 1999. We were all in this world just starting to make all these social networking connections on the web, and you, Katie, saw a void there, did you not?
Well, I guess so. It kind of came about by accident, really, because I was trying to start some kind of online business. Myself and my brother had a travel-related online business before that, so I was trying to do this all again, and the internet was starting to really take off at that time. And I just thought, you know, and let me tell you, a friend of mine, I was sitting in an office in central London, and it was raining, and it was dark and wet and cold outside and miserable. Yeah, I was feeling fairly depressed that evening,
yeah.
You know, and a friend of mine was sending me emails, and I was replying to them through the course of the afternoon and early evening, and thinking, I was just watching the clock and thinking about when I could finish work and go home, and I knew I had an hour's journey on the train to get back to where I lived, and I wasn't really looking forward to that, and so on and so forth. And then I thought my friend was in an office a couple of miles away, and then I discovered that he was actually sitting at a bar on the beach in the Maldives with a laptop computer.
Wow.
And I thought, and he told me that he was running his business from there, just from a laptop. You know, because it was a virtual business and he could go anywhere in the world with it. So I thought, this is the way forward. I've got to do this. So anyway, in about 1999, I was looking around and trying to find some kind of online business that I could do. And I'm failing dismally, I hasten to add. And I had actually tried to start a kind of, it wasn't really online, it was a business that would have a website and which offered vacations for transgender people in the UK. After about 6 months, I think I only had one single inquiry, and so I pretty much gave up. But I had about 6 months left on my hosting contract, and I thought, well, what shall I do with this website now for 6 months? So I thought, I know, I'll just put a few links on there to various transgender resources around the web, because there weren't that many of them then, and they were quite difficult to find.
Yeah.
We didn't have Google then, you know. So it wasn't that cut and dried. It wasn't that simple. So I thought, I'll try and make a page of resources that people can come to find the sites they really want. And I started to find quite a lot. And in the end, I ended up installing some search engine software And that actually went out and found me new sites, transgender-related sites, and that's when things really started going. And I was absolutely amazed at the amount of traffic that was suddenly coming through my little site.
I bet.
And then I think after that we added some, I added some forums, and that's when it all kicked off. As soon as I added the forums, people were signing up to join the forums, and then suddenly we had a membership site. And I don't know if any of your transgender listeners might remember this, but it was actually called TrannyWeb at that time.
Yeah.
And we kept on with that. We added photo galleries, and we all added blogs and a chat room and all the kind of things that, hey, you know, this was long before Facebook, remember?
Right.
This was, you know, a long time before Facebook existed. And we did all that way back in about, I guess, probably about 2000 or thereabouts, 2001. And it's still going today. It's got a different name now. It's now called the Gender Society. And it's a resource and for transgender people. It's also a social network and a place that people who who are transgendered and their friends and families can come for advice and support and friendship and information. You know, so it's all there, still going.
What do you remember about those first interactions? I would imagine that for trans folks who were and still are so desperately looking for community in various parts of the world where they can't access it, I would imagine that there was just such appreciation for the resource that you were putting out there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I speak to trans people every day.
Yeah.
A lot of the older folk tell me that, you know, back when they were young, when they were in their teens and in their 20s, there was no internet.
Right.
And a lot of people grew up thinking that there was something wrong with them, that they had some kind of mental illness.
Right.
You know? Because they just didn't understand these strange urges to dress in the opposite gender's clothing.
Yeah.
You know, it was a crazy thing. And then when the internet arrived, they suddenly realized that they weren't the only ones who felt that way, and that there was actually a community of people just like them all around the world who had the same experiences and had come up through the same mill, if you, so to speak.
Yeah.
So the internet made an enormous difference. As I say, in the early days, there weren't very many resources around for transgender people, but now there's just so much out there.
Including, I don't know if you know this, a magazine called Frock that people can turn to.
Frock magazine, yeah, we love Frock magazine. Well, Frock magazine grew out of the Gender Society. We, you know, I said we were adding all kinds of bells and whistles to it in order to get people through the door and make it, you know, an exciting place to come and visit, like chat rooms and forums and all that stuff. But we thought, we were actually originally thinking that we will try to find ways of getting people to sign up for our full membership, which is, although basic membership is free,
mm-hmm.
The majority of our members had gone for that because it didn't cost them any money,
right?
You know, but we still had bills to pay, and you know, so to keep our heads above water, we introduced a membership level which we called full membership, and we charged like $1 a week. We're not talking about big bucks here,
right?
Just $1 a week to do that, to become a full member, and that does actually pay our bills, and it does pretty much keep the wolf from the door. But, you know, there have been times when we haven't quite made enough money each month to pay all of our bills. And so we thought, well, let's try and entice people with more bells and whistles and give them more bang for their buck in the hope that they'll upgrade from basic to full. So someone came up with an idea and said, let's change our monthly newsletter. Let's make that into a proper magazine and offer it as the full members magazine, and it'll be an extra incentive for people to upgrade their membership. So we did that, and you know, for the first two or three months, the first two or three issues, I should say, of Frock magazine, it was only available to our full members, and there were about 600, you know. So we went to all that trouble creating a glossy magazine, which anyone who's ever worked in publishing will know is an enormous task.
Oh my gosh,
very,
yeah.
Very difficult. And we did all that work, and then only for about, well, 500 or 600 people who had access to it. And we, at the end of a few months, we thought, you know, this is a crazy thing that we're doing here. We've got hardly any readers. We really need to make this thing, you know, available to everyone to make it worth our while actually doing the work in the first place.
We're working too hard on this for 600 people.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So we took the decision to make it a free magazine and make it available to everybody all around the world. And that's what we've done. And so Proc Magazine since then, that was back in, 2009, I think. And since then, Proc, each new issue of Proc that comes out has been available for free, including the February issue.
Oh, we're going to talk about that. But let's back up a step. First, I have to tell you, and this is not to minimize the content of the magazine, because we're going to delve into the content, which I did a total immersion and loved every page of it. But just on an editorial and publishing level, it's a stunning publication, Katie.
Well, thank you so much. That's very kind of you to say that. We try really hard. One thing that we've always tried to do, and we may not always have succeeded, but we've always tried, whenever we introduce anything new at the Gender Society, we've always tried to make it as professional a job as possible. I think there were some times back in the early days when we introduced new features that weren't quite up to scratch,
Mm-hmm.
If you do that, then people just complain and moan, and then they walk away, and you never see them again. So we learned our lessons the hard way. We got our fingers burnt, and we realized, if you're going to do something, you've got to do it absolutely well. You've got to do it as well as you possibly can and make it a really professional job that people will go away and shout about,
Absolutely.
And we want, people like yourself. We want people to come and read our magazine and then say, hey, that's really good. We really like that. And go away and not just tell us, but tell their friends.
Oh, yeah. That's why we wanted you on the show. So let's talk about the content. So I was immersing myself in particular in the December, January issue, and just so many great pieces to this. I have to tell you, one that stood out to me, and we'll talk about several others as well, was just these couple pages written by a voice therapist, which quite frankly, Katie, is not something that, even with all the work that I do with the trans community, it just didn't even occur to me that that would be an integral feature. It was so well written, and I would imagine just so vital to feature in the magazine.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Your voice is possibly one of the most important cues you can give to other people if you're trying to pass in public, trying to tell people every human on the planet is subconsciously telling every other human what gender they are. It's the first thing that people notice about anyone new who comes into the room or anybody who passes them in the street. Subconsciously, the very first thing they notice, what gender is this person? And they look at cues. What clothes are they wearing? How long is their hair? The voice is possibly the most important thing of all. You can look Kim Kardashian, or you can look amazing, but then if you open your mouth and you talk like me and you have a deep male voice, that destroys the illusion straight away, and people will know immediately that you're perhaps not all you say you are, or maybe there's more to it than meets the eye, and they'll go back and they'll look closer. That's the thing that I think transgender people who are out and about in public don't want people to look closer. Usually, there are some,
right.
There are some who want everybody to look at them. But yeah, but I mean, most like transsexual people just want to blend in and not be noticed, really.
Yeah.
And if they do get noticed, they want an admiring glance. They want women to give them an admiring glance and men to, I don't know, how can I put this? they want to be treated like normal females.
Absolutely.
They don't want to be read. I don't know if you know, are familiar with that term.
Oh, yes.
Being read, is when you've been found out, and when a member of the public, you're in the supermarket and a member of the public walks by and realizes that perhaps there's more to you than meets the eye. Then you've been read. And you don't want that to happen because, it can very often end up in a difficult situation. Transgender people get attacked a lot. There's a lot of violence out there towards trans people. And so, if you can blend in and if you can play the part of the gender that you're trying to portray, you're that you identify with, then that's all well and good, isn't it?
Nice. Sort of, oh, absolutely.
And voice is just part, it's such an important part of that. Something I haven't mastered yet myself.
Well, one of the, I have to tell you, one of the most fun things about Frock is that you have this branded all the way through. There are all these different sections that incorporate in the word. We have frocking all over the world, Frock Doc, the Frockford Files. Which one is your favorite? I feel like there's one that you just love.
Oh, I love them all. I can't have a favorite. I'm not allowed to have a favorite. I would be if I put my finger on one in particular and said that's my favorite, I would be in such trouble with everybody else. So with all the other contributors. So I could never answer that one.
Well,
they're all great.
In particular, Frocking All Over the World is such a nice piece because it really brings together, and I think that's what you were doing originally on the web as well, and obviously what you're doing with the magazine, highlighting there are trans people everywhere and they have different stories to tell. So that's a particularly lovely piece of the magazine.
Yeah, I love that. In the current issue, February, we've got a lady from Poland, which is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, but people really are frocking all over the world. The issue that you were looking at, you've just been looking at the December of
yes.
January issue, our holiday issue, that featured Rosandra Fox from Perth in Western Australia.
Yes, absolutely.
It was indeed. And so, yeah, people really are frocking all over the world. And in each issue, we have people from Thailand, from Vietnam, from Spain, Portugal, you know, name a country. No country on this planet is immune to transgenderism. It happens everywhere.
Right.
You know? And I know a lot of countries would rather it didn't. A lot of regimes and governments don't agree with it, and religions don't really agree with it. But it's you know, it's a medical thing. It's not something that people have control of. Well, let me just quickly just mention, by
Please.
The way, when we first started the magazine, we had a little tagline on the front cover that said "Your Transgender Lifestyle Magazine." And you know, we got into such trouble with the community over that because people told us quite quickly, "Hey, you know, being transgender is not a lifestyle decision. It's not something you have any control over. It's something you're born with." And so, you know, hey, so we took the lifestyle thing off the front page, and we don't use that word anymore now because, again, we've learned from our mistakes, had our fingers burnt. We were talking about frocking all over the world.
Yeah.
We've got, it's a silly little theme that we have throughout the magazine where we use the word frock in various guises. We've got a section called Frock and Roll.
Yes.
Which is where we usually highlight some kind of musician or singer or whatever who's a transgendered person somewhere in the world. We've got Frock Chicks, of course, which is normally we have some kind of transgender model in that section. By the way, I should mention Frock is not in any way a porn mag. There's no nudity in
no,
there whatsoever.
No.
And we've got no age restriction either. It's available to minors. So, you know, there's nothing in Frock that you wouldn't find in an average daily newspaper. But it's just all, you know, transgender is the theme, but there's nothing naughty in there. There are plenty of other magazines that do that. We just figure we could do it nicely.
Well, can I also say the other thing that Frock Magazine is not, and I really do appreciate this, is that it's not just a magazine that's dedicated, as I feel like so many different sites are and so many different conceptions of trans are these days. It's not a magazine dedicated to those drag queens who are on RuPaul's Drag Race. You know, you feature them and you have different shout outs to entertainers, but I love the fact that you really have to, by definition, because it reflects reality, broaden the definition that so many folks have in popular culture of the transgender community.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we generally say transgender and drag now because, again, you know, you have to be so careful. People are so picky, and they get so cross if you say the slightest thing wrong, I've found. But, you know, an awful lot of drag queens don't consider themselves to be transgendered at all. You know, a lot of, Frank Marino, who's on the front cover of the current issue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with Frank.
Yes,
Frank
of course.
Frank is the longest-running headliner in Las Vegas.
He is a Vegas diva.
Yeah. Frank was telling me that he, in his house, he has no female apparel at all. No makeup, no false eyelashes, no women's clothes, nothing like that at all. He's, when he leaves the theatre and goes home, then the job is finished for the day, and he, you know, relaxes as a male, and he's got no desire to transition and become female. He's not even a cross-dresser. You know, he does this for a job of work, and he's a gay man who enjoys, I think he must get some satisfaction from dressing in drag, but I don't think he'd consider himself to be a cross-dresser or, and certainly not a transsexual. So, you know, hey, you know, that's just one other facet. There are so many, and you've got to be so careful. It's so easy to offend people by putting them in the wrong category or even try to categorize people at all. Some people get very, very cross.
Yeah,
very careful.
I bet. I bet. By the way, this is a total side note. Speaking with someone from England reminds me I want to start using the word cross more. It just sounds lovely. It's a good thing.
I should point out, I'm in England. I'm the editor. Our assistant editor is actually in Canada.
Look at that.
And yeah. Frock is not a British magazine at all. It's an international magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Our servers are in Canada and Florida. And over 50% of our readers are in the United States. The rest of the readers and our contributors, our writers, are from all over the world. We've got people in Hong Kong. We've got people in Germany, France, Switzerland. You know, you name it. We've got writers all over the place. We've got readers from all over the world as well. And so I think I'm probably one of the very few that happens to be in the UK. So that's just a kind of, don't think for one second that Frock is a British magazine.
No, this is an international
really
effort.
Absolutely. It is a team effort as well. I thank our little team, our hard-working but small team, every day for all the great things they do to keep Frock afloat. You know, when you have a free magazine that relies on, you know, maybe just a small band of advertisers to pay our bills, we really rely an awful lot on goodwill and on people's generosity and in coming forward and offering us writing and helping us with actually creating the magazine. So, you know, people generally kind of work for free, which is just as well, because if they wanted to be paid, we'd close down tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah. Frock is really a labor of love, you know.
It comes across. It comes across. Let me end with this piece. There's a lovely interview with you in a magazine called, and I hope I'm not mangling the name, is it Volup Magazine?
Oh, yeah, it's for voluptuous ladies.
Oh, look at that.
That's why it's called Volup.
Volup. I got it. And now I just got it, and you put it in the context. Well, in that piece, you said this. You said, quote, "I think the trans people are probably where the gay community was 20 years back. We have a long way to go to reach the level of acceptance that those communities enjoy today." Where do you hope that the trans community heads next, Katie? What do you want next steps to be?
Wow. I've seen an awful lot of change over the last, 15, 20 years. Certainly, you know, since we started the Gender Society as Trannyware back in 1999, things have really, really changed. You know, and I think for the most part, things have changed for the better. But, you know, the trans community still has one of the very highest suicide rates of any group, minority group in the world. Not just in the United States, but in other countries too. And, you know, right around the world, trans people are killing themselves every day. And if they're not killing themselves, then other people are killing them. You know, the murder rate among the, you know, in the trans community is huge. And trans people are marginalized. Trans people, when they come out to their employers, they lose their jobs. You know, when they come out to their families, they get disowned. They get thrown out of the house. And, you know, some radio and TV, well, TV shows, I'm not going to mention any names, but you know the ones I mean, have really made out that trans people are bad for whatever reason, for years and years. We've seen this for decades and decades. Whenever they have transgender guests, they always seem to be involved in armed robberies or they take drugs or they're in the sex trade or whatever. There's always something negative going on. You know, they're always portrayed in a negative way. Things are kind of turning around very slowly, but It's a very slow process, but I can see light at the end of the tunnel, and I'd say that maybe in another 10, 15 years' time, maybe, I don't know, maybe trans people will be as accepted as perhaps gay people are, I don't know. But trans people are really lagging behind there, and they need it. They need all the help they can get.
Well, they are getting a ton of help, not just the trans community, but really just the worldwide community at large are getting a ton of help by the efforts of you and your team in putting out Frock Magazine. As I said, this is not just some throwaway publication of very niche marketing and very targeted articles that you know, I would only read this if I were trans. It's just not like that at all. Obviously, there are pieces that are of interest to the trans community, but, and I'm going to go right back to this word, it's a stunning publication that without question, Katie, you and your team are creating community and providing folks with an access point, both the trans community and just the worldwide community. You're providing this place for folks to come together and do some reflection, and it's entertaining and it's branded. You got the word frock so many different times, but it really yeah. is a community gathering place. And you've been doing this for so long, but what a lovely manifestation of it, Katie. It's just great.
Well, you know, we try. We really do. We've got a lot of readers, which is good, but there's always room for some more. And because the magazine is an online magazine, so you don't need to have it delivered to your door by a postman.
Right.
There's no need to worry about hiding it under the bed.
Right.
And, you know, you just go along to the frockmagazine.com website, and you don't even download it. It's actually appears on the screen, and it's got flipping pages like a real magazine.
It does.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
does.
And,
so,
and it costs
yeah.
nothing. I say it costs nothing. I'm talking about the desktop version, and the reason for that is because it's those people who know about computers will understand when I say it's flash-based, and unfortunately, our friends at Apple if you have an iPad or an iPhone or whatever, then you'll know that Apple don't support Flash.
Right.
And so the desktop, the free version, won't work on an iPad. But if you have a desktop computer, you can, you know, with Windows, or if you've got a Mac or a Linux computer, no problem. Go straight to it at frockmagazine.com. And dive in.
Love it, love it. Well, again, listeners, the February issue is out now. The website is frockmagazine.com. You can also check out the Gender Society by going to gendersociety.com. Katie, we didn't even get a chance to talk about frocktv.com, which means you got to come back on the show, okay?
Yeah, Frock TV, yay!
All right, we're going to get back to that. Katie, you and your team, what a great job you're doing. Please keep going with Frock Magazine and keep giving us amazing content. Our best to all our buddies over there in England. Tell everyone we said hi.
Surely, yes, thank you. And Ken, thank you. And, you know, I have a feeling we need to get you into Frock.
I am all for it. That's a resume builder for me, Katie. So, listeners, stay tuned for that. Katie, what an absolute treat having you on the show. Thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Thank you so much, Ken. Have a good day.
It takes a lifetime to become the best that we can be. We have not the time or the right to judge each other. It's one life, and there's no return and no deposit. One life. So make sure you like what's in your closet.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, you would have to be living under a rock right now to not know that the Olympics are taking place right this very second, and you'd have to be living under a rock without internet to not know that the controversy around Russia's policy on its LGBT citizens has cast, you know, somewhat of a pall on these games for quite some time now. A few weeks back, The Advocate ran a cover story entitled Love in Putin's Russia that really caught my eye and framed this issue in an incredible way. Here to talk about that piece is the author, Chadwick Moore. Chadwick is a freelance reporter for the New York Times, Out, and other publications. He's got a background in literary publishing in New York and London, and now he's here with us. Chadwick, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Thank you, Ken. It's great to be here.
So much to talk about. Are you ready?
Yes, let's do it.
How did it come to pass, let's dive right in, that you found yourself in Russia writing this piece?
I was actually, a friend of mine, we were in a bar in Brooklyn this summer right after the anti-gay law passed in Russia, And we were talking it over, and a lot of the headlines coming out were, it was a lot of reporters in New York, kind of secondhand accounts of violence against gay people in Russia. And I was saying to my friend, like, there's no one on the ground reporting this. And he just said, well, why don't you go to Russia? So, you know, a few beers in, I sent an email to my editor out, and I was like, hey, you know, what's going on? Are you sending anyone to Russia? And he got back to me right away. It was a Friday afternoon, which I don't know, for any writers out there, it's pretty rare that your editor gets back to you right away. And so we talked about it for a few months, and then in November, they put me on a plane, and I went to Moscow.
Wow. Now, tell me about that moment when you told your friends and family that you were going. As someone who goes to, you know, Uganda every other year, my family's not so into it. I can't imagine your family was, like, crazy excited.
You're right about that, yeah. They were pretty worried about me. And a lot of my friends were worried, and a lot of people I don't know very well on Facebook and Instagram were expressing concern over my safety. I wasn't worried really at all. Their concerns kind of got me thinking, like, is this really stupid? Should I be doing this?
Right.
But yeah, you know, my mother was very scared. She wanted to go. My father was more supportive, but I could tell he was a little nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah. My sister was also kind of freaking out about that too.
Did you have to set up a, hey, I'm going to email you every 10 minutes and everything will be fine?
Yeah, I did just to calm them down. And, you know, once I was there, I got so wrapped up running around Moscow and hanging out with people, I kind of forgot. I got all these messages. What's going on? Where are you? And, you know, I had to, like, you know, I didn't have much internet coverage, so I'd email my boyfriend and be like, look, can you just let my whole family know I'm okay? I don't have time to talk to them right now.
I love the idea that the Moore family is calling the Russian embassy at all hours.
I know they were on the verge of it.
All right, so you're on a plane, you're going to Russia. Obviously, I'm sure you put in a lot of work going into it to set up time to talk to different people. But you know, there's also the piece where you're going to be there for a finite amount of time. How do you go about wrapping your mind around the piece that you want to write?
That's a good question. I didn't really know what to expect when I got there. I just knew I wanted to do a piece about the ordinary lives of gay Russians. I really didn't want to get so heavily into the politics because mm-hmm. we're all very familiar. And so the contacts I was setting up beforehand were just very loosely organized. Just, hey, does anybody know any gay people in Moscow who want to hang out and, you know, take me in their homes and go to the nightclubs with them. And I wasn't so keen on talking to activists, although I did meet a lot of activists and did end up writing about them in my piece and talking to them. So I guess I kind of went in there very loosey-goosey. Mm-hmm. And once I got there, just I was just so infatuated by the place and by the people, the story just started kind of coming together.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this piece. It's an incredible piece. And I have to say, by the way, I really appreciate, because sometimes I get a little frustrated with some of our publications, that the pieces that are published about really in-depth issues like this are very short. Yours is not a short piece for The Advocate, which I appreciated.
Yeah, thank you for that. I agree with you. I'm on the same page with you. A lot of gay publications, they're very narrow-minded in their scope on these kind of stories. They don't tend to look at bigger issues of what's going on in the country. You know, there's so much going on in Russia. There's so much to say about Russia. And to just kind of focus on this one law as being the most horrible thing that's ever happened to the gay community is kind of silly. You really need to take a bigger picture and look at the whole country, the politics, the history, and just the fact that there are average people there living their lives, and not everyone in the country is as beastly homophobic as a lot of people are being led to believe.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the piece. Let's dive in. Some quotes from here. You wrote in this piece, a high degree of emotion is set free in the secret labyrinth of gay nightlife. There was Amin, a 21-year-old Muslim sex worker from Chechnya, a dapper, muscular, self-conscious little charmer with black eyes and acne-kissed cheeks, who twice cried on my shoulder in the downstairs lounge at Central Station, a diner-like space varnished in Soviet Manila. And then you go on to write about Tatiana, the 40-year-old divorcee. Her only friends, a gaggle of 20-year-old hairdressers, also cried on me while recalling her ex-husband and spent the night asking strangers for beers. Before we even get into this, question number one, is this something that regularly happens to you, even in New York City, that people cry on your shoulder?
Probably with more frequency than your average person.
Wow, look at that.
Tell me I'm easy to talk to.
Because I walked away with that. I walked away with the impression that, yes, this happens to you often.
People do tend to open up to me a lot. I would say that to the extent of the crying and stuff, it was kind of marked enough in Russia that I felt the need to put it in the story that
oh, yeah.
didn't necessarily happen all the time in New York, although that's not to say that it doesn't happen.
On a more serious side, you're there. Yeah. You're there in Russian gay nightlife. You obviously, as you said, and you lived in New York City. I'm from New York City. It's its own scene there. What was going through your head as you were socializing with folks there?
That's a good question. I kept thinking how Moscow is a huge city. It's much bigger than New York, but it's not cosmopolitan at all. Which really shocked me when I was there. So, you know, the vibe is sort of nothing like New York or London or you know, big capitals that we're familiar with. It's very, it still feels very Russian, it still feels very Soviet, it still feels very orderly and kind of oppressed. And you're not apt to see people who look very fashionable and kind of stand out. Everyone kind of looks the same. And in the nightclubs, it was very similar to that, and that it reminded me of gay bars that you go to in small cities. You know, I'm originally from the South, and like gay bars in Alabama or something that had a very kind of provincial, I don't want to sound insulting, but like, it felt very small towny.
Yeah.
It felt
absolutely
kind of, yeah, lots of oppression and, you know, there were lots of visitors also from who didn't live in Moscow. It was a huge part of the scene where people, very, very young people coming from all over the country on vacation and, you know, very thrilled to be in a gay bar but also just very provincial feeling. It didn't feel very vibrant, sophisticated, big in the way that like the gay scene in New York often feels.
Right. Right. Well, this is the section that I just blew me away, and my God, incredible writing here. You wrote, quote, "It is here that I understand the incredible short-sightedness of gay civil disobedience in Russia. The country is maiming its women on a scale that cannot be compared to the kind of violence seen in sporadic viral videos of neo-Nazis torturing gay people. Yet when the Olympics come, there will be inevitably some activist waving a rainbow flag on camera. The West will cheer and pat itself on the back while the whole of Russia will say, what a nice flag. I wonder what that means." So on this first level, amazing writing, my friend.
Thank you very much.
On the content piece, how do you wrap your mind around? You're someone from the West coming in. You wrote about at the very start of the piece, you know, everyone's concerns and how this is so much in our media presence. How do you then encapsulate, you know, what you learned about what we all think about civil disobedience in Russia about gay people?
Well, it's interesting because I couldn't even – I had a line that got cut that I couldn't really use the term gay rights movement when talking about what's going on in Russia. So I called it gay civil disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I originally called it gay-themed civil disobedience because there's not a rights movement, because there's not really a gay community in Russia. There aren't really any communities in Russia. And in the sense of how we think of communities here in the United States particularly – and I guess somewhat in Europe, even though in America there is more of a sense of community activism, of grassroots movements, of, you know, just people taking it upon themselves to make things better for groups that are more marginalized.
Right.
You don't really see that in Russia at all. And Russians are still very skeptical of leaders. They're still very skeptical of groups and organizations. They mostly just want to kind of live their lives and be left alone. So when you see these gay rights activists in Moscow or St. Petersburg, and they're making the news, and they're getting, you know, they're getting maimed by the police and arrested and what have you. A lot of those people, and I learned this talking to activists in Moscow, a lot of them are straight people, a lot of them are foreigners, and a lot of them are gay Russians who spend a lot of time in the West. So your average gay Russian, I left with the impression that your average gay Russian, just they don't want any part of this. They don't actually even like the fact that there are people trying to have parades and marches in Russia. They think it's the wrong approach to gay rights, and they think that it makes things more difficult for them because it just draws all sorts of attention that they don't necessarily want.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's, you know, that's just denial or fear, I don't know. But the, you know, the rainbow flag is an interesting thing because, like, nobody in Russia knows that a rainbow flag is representative of gay rights.
Right.
You know, we think that they see that and they associate it, but they don't. people I was talking to, I was talking to some gay guys having this conversation, and they said, yeah, where would a Russian person learn that? Like, they wouldn't know
right.
what that flag means. They talked about being in a, there was one instance of a gay rights march, and some neo-Nazis came looking to beat up the gay people, and there were all these people with rainbow flags, and the neo-Nazis didn't associate that the rainbow flags meant that they were the ones marching for gay rights. Like, they mostly left those people alone. It's interesting that I left, some of the activists I spoke to told me that the gay rights movement there is very much a kind of symptom of just general youth culture unsatisfied with the way things are in Russia. So
yeah.
It's kind of this blanket, they're kind of taking, because gay rights are in the global vanguard right now, they're sort of taking that issue, but it really, they're talking about free speech, you know, they're talking about Pussy Riot, they're talking about all sorts of things in Russia. But it's kind of gay, the gay rights umbrella is being used for that. In the West, we think it's this kind of Stonewall-like climate. Sometimes people think that, but it's not that at all.
Well, you've been back for a few months. The conversations continue to go on. Obviously, they're ramping up as the Olympics are underway. Do you find yourself participating in more conversations about Russia, or are you taking a step back? Because I would imagine you're feeling fairly representative of someone who's been there and seen much more nuance than is being presented here.
Yeah, I still really enjoy talking about Russia to people, particularly my friends or people I'm meeting. I'm getting a little less frustrated by some of the media coverage that I think is a little short-sighted.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting really angry about it, you know, right after I came back. And, no, you don't know what's going on there.
Right.
It's so much more complicated. And, you know, like, let's look, don't just focus on this. Look at the whole country for
right.
things to get better. So it's interesting that even some of the you know, most elite bylines in New York media are still kind of telling the same story about Russia. You know, like David Remnick at The New Yorker, Masha
yeah.
Gessen, who just moved here. They're very on this incredibly narrow-minded one-issue thing. Like, gay people, you know, it's almost like they're framing it as the road to genocide for gay people in Russia. But, I mean, of course, because they have this law, something like that could always happen in Russia.
Yeah.
I don't really see that what's happening right now. After the Games, if things were to get worse for gay people in Russia, the next step is probably going to be to take children away from gay parents. I don't think that's going to happen, although it very well could, and I know that's why Masha Gessen came to the U.S., and I certainly think that was a very smart move on her part. But it's just really difficult to say what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, the name of the piece is Love in Putin's Russia. Everybody can check it out. You can just Google it. You can go to advocate.com. This is a lengthy piece, which I appreciated. Can we talk about a couple of your other pieces that you've put out there? Because I did a little Chadwick Moore immersion. So a couple of your other pieces, because there's so many different LGBT themes, so much appreciated your piece called No Judging About Gay Players on Basketball Courts, mostly because I used to live right there on West 4th and I missed that basketball court. But what a fun piece collecting quotes from different folks about Jason Collins coming out.
Yeah, that was great. That was really last minute, really fun. I emailed it was the day after Jason Collins came out. I emailed my editor and I'm like, let's go around to these basketball courts and just ask these guys what they think. And so I had, you know, a couple hours, I'd run into the city, I'd write the whole thing on my phone. You know, those players were great. They were, you know, New York City is such a wonderful, special place. And all those guys were just so cool. I mean, you know, I was a little disappointed because I was hoping, like, I really wanted to get, you know, some homophobic statements in
right.
here. I got to balance it out. Couldn't find one.
Nice.
These streetball players who are so tough, you know, they're great. They're just like, yeah, I don't care, you know. It's great, good for him, not a problem with me. Yeah, I'd play with him, he's a good player. Who cares, you know? Unfortunately, because of time restraints, I really want to go. I want to do a bigger piece all over the city and go into the Bronx and go into all these other places. But unfortunately, I just could hit up two courts in that afternoon. But it was a fun piece. It really made you feel, you know, as a gay person in New York, it just made you feel how wonderful the people in the city are.
I'm chuckling at the image of you standing out on a bench, you know, right outside the McDonald's right there on West 4th, just yelling, please, is there anyone homophobic here? Anyone? Come here. Nobody? Come on.
That's exactly what it was. I'm like, come on, man. Would you shower with the guy? Yeah, I'd shower with him. I don't care. Oh, all right, okay, you're a lovely person.
I think it's fine for Jason Collins to come out and Chadwick saying, well, he thinks you're pretty and kind of feminine. What do you think now? You know, just Keep pressing them. Now, there was another piece that I might be reading too much into this, and you're the author, so you get to say, Ken, you're reading too much into this. But you wrote a piece called In North Brooklyn, Another Gay Bar Closes. And we've talked, you know, over the past 6 years of the show, we've talked a lot about LGBT culture and nightlife, and having lived the past 6 years in Vermont, where there's not a gay bar in the entire state of Vermont. And anytime I brought it up, folks were like, well, we don't need one. It's so accepting. But implicit in your piece, and tell me if I'm wrong, was this idea of gay bars dying out is not a good thing. We're not just shooting for, you know, just 100% bars that are accepting to everyone, that there is this very individualized sense of nightlife that we're losing a bit. Am I reading too much into it?
You know, I think you're right. And I'll tell you why in a minute. But that story was mainly, I don't know, with that story, I think it's different because there seemed to be, the neighborhood where it closed was Greenpoint, which is a very old Polish family who've been there for a while, and lots of young people, a lot of them gay, who've moved in, and they're very much butting up against each other. You don't really get the impression that the Polish community is all that thrilled about seeing all these, you know, young gay people walking around the streets.
Right.
It was that gay bar, Veronica's, closed because of a lawsuit, and, you know, the neighbors clearly didn't like them there and seeing all these drag queens everywhere. But there are other issues that I mentioned in the story about just the way the bar was managed and things like that. It followed the neighborhood's most well-known gay bar, Metropolitan. The community board voted not to renew their liquor license that year, which is very interesting because that's in nearby Williamsburg, which is a neighborhood that's now basically all bars.
Right.
So, you know, there's kind of this, like, some people in the community thought it was homophobic. Others are thinking, you know, who are you kidding? It's just business. But back to what you were saying, it's interesting because actually the next piece I'm writing for Out, which will be coming out soon, involves nearby Bushwick, Brooklyn, which is one neighborhood east of Williamsburg, which has become this new hot spot for young people and gay people. And in that neighborhood, it's interesting that there aren't any gay bars, but there are, as you're describing, bars where everyone hangs out together and it's all fine. And you go to any number of places and you know there's going to be a lot of gay people there, a lot of straight people, a lot of people from all different backgrounds, all hanging out together. So it seems in that neighborhood the need for an exclusive gay bar, and especially among this younger generation that's grown up with, as they have, with social media and Grindr and the laws
right.
changing and all that, it seems the need for specific gay bar isn't really there. They do fine just out in all the other bars.
Interesting. Oh, man. I think I just felt old there for a second, Chadwick.
I know. I'm 30, and I feel old when I go to Brooklyn or when I go into Bushwick.
Just kind of like, I guess, you know, this is the evolution. Well, everybody can stroll on over to chadwickmoore.com. That's M-O-O-R-E, and we'll provide a link to that. There's a ton of other articles on there, including a piece about why I will never go in a park in Brooklyn ever again because now I'm petrified of a mockingbird just pecking my head. So thanks for that, Chadwick. It's a little scary. And a piece, I have to say, there's another piece there that folks should check out called For Gay Arabs, A Place to Dance and Break Down Walls. And I know that got a lot of attention. It's a great piece. The subject of today's interview, Love and Putin's Russia, could not be more topical given the Olympics. And Chadwick, you add nuance and you add voice where a lot of us are just not seeing that right now. So it's an extraordinarily well done piece and much needed.
Thank you very much.
Keep on writing.
All right. Thank you, Ken.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, a little bit of time left on this week's episode, so we bring to you some gay news and my own views. This week, from all around the world, the news, we start in New York City, where New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has said that he will not march in the city's St. Patrick's Day parade because event organizers do not allow gay rights groups to participate. He said, quote, "I simply disagree with the organizers of that parade and their exclusion of some individuals in this city." Parade organizers do not allow gay rights groups or marchers with gay pride signs to participate in the event, saying that doing so would conflict with the Roman Catholic heritage of the event, which traces its roots back to the colonial era. This mayor, our new mayor of New York City, he becomes the first mayor to boycott the event since David Dinkins, the last Democrat elected in the office in 1993. So it's been over 20 years since a New York City mayor has said, you know what, I'm not going to participate. So the hope is that maybe some change will happen, but this has been going on for a pretty darn long time. So I'm not anticipating a lot of change there in the St. Patrick's Day parade, but nice job, mayor, for taking a stand. We like that. In North Carolina, in a very bizarre video, which if you haven't watched it, you should watch it because I don't know, I didn't love it, but I like the announcement. Out singer Clay Aiken has made his bid for a congressional seat in North Carolina with a video that was published on YouTube just this week. Aiken, if you don't know, he certainly earned his stripes through American Idol and also The Celebrity Apprentice. I did not watch him on The Idol, but I did see him on The Celebrity Apprentice. And he wants to represent North Carolina's 2nd Congressional District. In the first moments of his campaign video, again, I watched it, he said, quote, "I think that Congress is dysfunctional at this point." He also admits that he's a Democrat running for a seat in a traditionally conservative district, but according to the Raleigh News Observer, the 2nd Congressional District is one of the most likely targets for a Democratic victory over a Republican incumbent in 2014. It's a bit of a weird video. I don't know. It's got some after-school special theme to it, and it starts out all about how he used to sleep on the floor of a living room with his mom. And again, I respect his background and certainly sounds like he's overcome quite a bit, but I don't know. There's a flavor to it I don't particularly love. But yay, out entertainer Clay Aiken now making a bid for the United States Congress. Very, very exciting there in North Carolina. Hey, in India, in a powerful visual display of solidarity and outrage, LGBT Indians and their allies turned out in record numbers for the annual Pride celebration just last week in Mumbai. An estimated 5,000 people, both Indian citizens and visitors from abroad, descended upon Mumbai's August Kranti Maidan, where the pro-LGBT march began. The 7th annual Pride celebration, known as the Queer Azadi March, was the first Pride event ever to take place since India's Supreme Court reinstated a colonial era law in December, this crazy colonial era law that criminalizes gay sex or, quote, any carnal intercourse against the order of nature with man, woman, or animal, and it imposes a 10-year prison sentence on those who violate the law. So very exciting that these folks, in really not just a display of pride, but bravery too for the possible consequences that could face them. One participant expertly summed up the Indian LGBT community's collective outrage at the Supreme Court's decision to reinstate the 150-year-old law. He said, quote, "We are warriors against 377, and that's what we need to do now, because now the battle has gone bigger, with the Supreme Court also rejecting our review petition." And so the law is actually called Section 377, and that's why he said, "We are warriors against 377. So our hearts are with you, and we have your backs in whatever way we can, at least emotionally, if we're not there physically with our brothers and sisters there in Mumbai. Kind of a really terrible and depressing story. We talk about all this different drug use and suicidality being astronomically higher in our LGBT teen population, and apparently that trend continues and extends to steroid use. Gay and bisexual adolescent boys in the U.S., it was just found, are almost 6 times more likely to use illicit steroids than their straight counterparts. Researchers say the stats show a, quote, "dramatic disparity that points up a need to reach out to this group." Reasons for the differences are unclear. The study authors say it's possible that gay and bisexual boys feel more pressure to achieve a bulked up ideal male physique, or the researchers think that these boys are thinking that muscle building steroids will help them fend off bullies. Overall, 21% of gay or bisexual boys said they had used steroids versus 4% of straight boys. 21% of gay and bisexual boys using steroids versus 4% of straight boys. That's just a huge difference. The difference was similar among those who reported moderate use, taking steroid pills or injections up to 40 times. 8% of gay or bi teens reported that amount versus less than 2% of straight boys. The heaviest use So individuals who said that they've used steroids 40 times or more, it was reported that 4% of gay or bisexual boys had reported that heavy use compared with less than 1% of straight teens. That's a huge difference, huge difference. The study is billed as the first to examine the problem. Previous research has found similar disparities for other substance use, as we've covered many times on the show. So the quote from co-author Aaron Blosshill, who is a psychologist and scientist with the Fenway Institute, he said, quote, "It's a bit sad that we saw such a large health disparity. Given the dramatic disparity, it would seem that this is a population in which greater attention is needed." So even with steroid use really affecting LGBT teens, it's something that we should all be paying attention to. Turning our attention to England, going over to England, a United Kingdom, this is an unbelievable story, a United Kingdom Independence Party councillor, so an elected official there. This is a guy, okay, his name is David Sylvester. He's a member of the Henley Town Council. He made headlines a few weeks ago when he wrote a letter to his local newspaper saying that the floods that were happening there in England were caused because of Prime Minister David Cameron's successful move to change the law about same-sex marriage. Well, then, this past week, the town council met and they voted unanimously to distance themselves from his views, okay, from David Sylvester's views. And then, bizarrely, David Sylvester also voted for the motion to distance themselves from him. He then took the floor. This is where it gets fun. He then took the floor and refused to resign. He refused to resign completely. And he called for gay people to seek repentance from God. And then he added that he stood by his earlier comments in that newspaper. Speaking to this packed town hall chamber, this is what he said, quote, "Never was it my intention to insult the gay community, and I certainly apologize to them if personal insult has been their perception." He added that his aim had been, in fact, to criticize the government for passing that same-sex marriage bill and ignoring the national textbook, which is, he said, the Holy Bible. He said, quote, "I have read that I am barmy," which I guess is an English phrase. We're learning all these English phrases this episode. He said, "I have read that I am barmy to connect this to the weather. If that is the case, then I am in good company." And he cited other senior bishops who had blamed the floods on the abandonment of the Bible's teaching. And then he went on to say, because of course, you can't say something anti-gay without then saying, "And by the way, I am not anti-gay." He said, quote, "The Jesus I serve welcomes all possible types of person, whether straight or gay. All they have to do is come to him in repentance and faith." So to sum up, he said the floods are caused by the gays, but it was really a critique of the government, and Jesus loves everybody. So there you go. A lot of controversy around President Obama's State of the Union address. I watched it. I watched it there. Some say it didn't go far enough. Gay folks, sorry, LGBT folks say it didn't go far enough. Some people felt that his shout out to Russia in the Olympics, not really a shout out, but hey, we're going there in unity or equality. I don't remember exactly what he said. I don't have it right in front of me. Was a real direct quote of condemning Russia's policies against LGBT people, the fact that he didn't say anything about the word gay or LGBT, that to me is, well, hey, it wasn't as direct as it could be, so I don't know what to make of that. We have one more episode for you next week, which is going to be jam-packed and so exciting and really fun, folks, on that episode before we get to our 250th episode, which is in just 2 weeks. So excited, folks that I've always wanted to speak to, who it took me 6 years to get on this show. So very excited about that, but I'm not telling you who. You got to tune in. For now, get out there. Go do some incredible things. Use your voice, my friends, the way you know how to use it. We've been talking about voice all episode long, the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference, and please do it, don't just be a pundit. Don't just decry things. Try to actually build something up as well. While you're building things up and making a difference, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?